enough money to live on. Kara and Richard M., both artists, took on a job as apartment managers. Their place was furnished and free. Their commute was nil. Their job costuming was a few grungy thrift store outfits for doing the dirty work. Plus, they got a monthly income. All this meant that they could get rid of their day jobs and spend more time on their art. Getting around. Consider this. For nearly all human history, people walked or rode in carts pulled by other animals. After nomadic foraging gave way to agricultural settlements, most people never traveled more than 10 miles from their home in their whole lifetime. The internal combustion engine didn't exist until the 1860s, when Nicholas Otto first patented the engine now in your auto. That's only 150 years ago. Only a fraction of humans on this planet today own a car. People get around and always have, but it's our curious minds, not vehicles with engines, that have propelled us around the world. So let's just get some perspective as we see how we might, in our short lifetimes, frugalize our ride. For most people, a car is the second most expensive thing they buy after a house. And the annual cost of owning a car is high, including insurance, registration, maintenance, repairs, gas, and depreciation. If you have to own a car, get something that's reasonably reliable and fuel efficient, maintain it well, and keep it for as long as you can. This will nearly always be cheaper than buying a new car, even over the long run. Then find ways to drive it less to wear it out slower. Join a carpool. Take the bus, live closer to work, work from home some days if you can, and do errands on foot or bicycle. Ask your employer if you could work a four-day week, which would reduce your commuting costs and get you off the road during rush hour. Those who live in cities have a number of alternatives to owning a car, including public transportation, car sharing, both peer-to-peer and fleets, bike sharing, on-demand car services, taxis, and traditional rental cars. With all those options and the high cost of parking, it's often cheaper and more convenient to not own a car in a big city. Even if you don't live in a big city, see if you can find a way to avoid owning a second car. You will save a lot of your hard-earned cash, and you might find other benefits as well. Rosemary I did the math and with considerable trepidation sold her one and only car. Her city had a car-sharing co-op, so she joined for her once a week stocking up at the hardware, grocery, and other stores. She calculated that renting a car for her once-a-month weekend in the country, plus her once-a-week errands, cost her a fraction of what she was paying for insurance, registration, monthly payments, repairs, and maintenance on the car she owned. And sometimes she could coax a friend to go camping with her in the friend's car, adding the advantage of human companionship to the joy of communing with nature. She paid for the gas, and for the two together, the pleasure was doubled while the cost was halved. A bargain. As a home remodeler, Ted Y. rationalized his two extra vehicles, an old pickup and another beater, as useful for hauling tools and materials to his job. Since they weren't worth much on the open market, he'd assumed it was cheaper to keep them. Not true. Doing his monthly tabulations showed him the high cost of the convenience of having and maintaining these backup vehicles. After calculating the cost of the new transmission, the insurance, and licensing, Ted found that he could just rent an extra truck for less money when he needed it. He sold off both extra vehicles. Taking care of your body. Medical costs are extremely high, so staying well is good for your wallet as well as good for your body. Your best basic health insurance is a healthy diet, exercise, good rest, and low stress. Although new medical studies are always coming out that seem to conflict with the previous ones, keep up on health recommendations that gain credibility. Prevention is key. take full advantage of the benefits of your health insurance, including preventive visits and screenings, life coaching, mental health screenings, and health club membership if they offer that. Some employers also offer savings accounts that allow employees to save, invest, and spend tax-free earnings for qualified health expenses. If you're paying for your own health insurance, shop carefully and see if you qualify for any state-run, more affordable plans. If you're generally healthy, you can opt for health insurance with a higher deductible and a lower premium, potentially saving you money. Prevention also avoids one of the costliest ways to access a doctor, the emergency room. Nip illnesses in the bud, and you can nip ruinous medical expenses in the bud as well. If you don't have health insurance, prevention and comparison shopping are even more important. Keep an eye out for health fairs where you can often get basic blood work and tests done for free or a minimal charge. If your teeth need care, consider visiting a dental school in your area, where student dentists often provide excellent care at a fraction of the usual cost. Also, remember that many doctors have privileges at several different hospitals, and find out which ones your doctor can use and comparison shop for the lowest price. You'll be surprised at how much the daily rates and operating room costs vary from one hospital to the next. Because of the high cost of surgery and health insurance in the United States, millions of people a year travel to other countries to get expensive medical procedures done. Organizations like Patients Without Borders help these medical tourists to find care they need in other countries, where it can cost anywhere from 20 to 90% less than the same procedure in the States. Caveat emptor, in neon letters, though, if you have complications once you are home, you may have to pay hometown prices for help, thereby negating your savings. Be sure to do your research before embarking on this journey. Sharing and bartering. Studies consistently show that one of the paths to happiness and frugality is being involved in community. One quick way to build community and save money is sharing your stuff, as we said earlier about cars, either renting or lending it. There are systems designed specifically for brokering trades, like alternative local currencies, babysitting co-ops, and time banks. Neighborhood listservs create nearby mutual aid networks. With time banks, people swap hour for hour. For example, giving a haircut can be exchanged for accompanying someone to a doctor visit or helping with their computer. Think of a skill you have and a service you need. Get creative. Sharing is a win-win, and you get the bonus of community in the process. Eating. No matter how frugal we become, almost all of us have to spend at least some money on food. Once you begin tracking your expenses, you'll see how much eating out can cost. Making the time to enjoy cooking a meal at home and even entertaining friends that way instead of going out is a sure way to save money and improve your health. Starting a garden can help keep the cost of produce you eat down, especially if you're used to buying organic. There are many ways to save money on groceries. Some are obvious and some are not. Obvious tips include making a list and sticking to it, knowing what's on sale at your local store, clipping or getting online coupons, avoiding convenience food, and buying in bulk. Eating with the seasons also saves money. By not insisting on peaches in February and strawberries in September, you can lower your grocery bill significantly and enjoy food that is both tastier and much more sustainably produced. The most expensive item on most people's weekly grocery bill are meat, alcohol, and coffee. Look carefully at your consumption of these and see if you can reduce them or make a special effort to get them at a cheaper price. Michael Pollan's pithy 7-word food rule, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, has helped people rethink meat as more of a condiment than an entree. Look into joining a bulk buying co-op with friends and neighbors to save on many of your staples. We so identify food with what is sold in the store that we don't realize how much of it grows wild all around us. You can glean a willing farmer's fields, ask your neighbor if they are okay with you taking their extra fruit, or eat berries from wild bushes. In the Pacific Northwest, our untamable blackberries make gluttons of us all. Good food and community for free. Staying connected, informed, and entertained. Look at how much you spend every year on your phone plan, data package, cable, and internet at home. And maybe that old standby, a landline. Subscriptions to music and video streaming services, your favorite new sites, and maybe even a newspaper or a few magazines. What was once relatively simple has become very complex and expensive. How can we rein in this monster and still get what we need? First of all, if you're locked into a traditional, expensive phone contract, don't renew it. There are phone plans that can cost you a quarter of what you're paying, saving you thousands of dollars a year if you have a family of phone users. Pay-as-you-go plans means you're not paying for minutes or megabytes you don't use. If you spend most of your day at home or at work, where you have Wi-Fi, leave data off and just turn it on when you need it. And use internet messaging and calling apps instead of the phone and text messaging. No contract plans allow you to shop around and switch anytime you find a better deal with no penalty. Plans that allow you to bring your own device means you can buy used phones. Last year's flagship phone sells for a couple hundred dollars less now. Don't need the latest? An older smartphone in good condition can be found for around $100. Once you've accepted a mobile phone as part of your daily life, consider ditching that expensive landline if you still have one. What about television and movies? Follow the example of cord cutters who have found that they can replace their expensive cable or satellite package with a combination of an old-fashioned over-the-air antenna and streaming services. Depending on where you live, an over-the-air antenna can deliver local channels with a picture and sound quality that exceeds cable and satellite, and it's free. There's lots of free streaming content available, and you can always rent a movie or series to supplement that. If you must subscribe to a paid streaming service, do some research and try to choose just one that best fits your needs and tastes. The same goes for streaming music services. While it's important to support journalism sites, magazines, and newspapers you care about with paid subscriptions, be sure to consider the cost of these, especially when much of that information and perspective is available elsewhere for free. Speaking of print, public libraries are an even better resource now than they were a generation ago. The ability to easily get books from other branches in your local system has increased the selection of books you can borrow. Most libraries have also added digital services, allowing you to borrow downloadable ebooks and audiobooks from home, and it's still all free to you, already paid for with your tax dollars. Getting away. As your handling of money gets clearer and your life becomes more satisfying, you will have less of a need to vacate. Consider relaxing closer to home. You may even enjoy taking a vacation in your own house, a staycation. Given the amount of time you work for the privilege of owning or renting your abode, you are entitled to relax and appreciate it for a week. If you do want to get away, any change in location might do. 3 miles or 300 miles are both away. Reflect on your true needs, and you may find that a day trip and a new or used hammock for the backyard would be just as satisfying as a traditional week away. Camping is also an inexpensive way to get away, relax, and experience nature's beauty on a shoestring. If you decide to travel further afield, there are numerous ways to do this on the cheap. If you're flying, use the most effective travel search engines to find the cheapest fares. Be flexible on dates, times, and locations, and subscribe to sites and price alerts that can uncover unpublished, deeply discounted flights. These can easily be half the cost of a normal fare. If you have the discipline, you can try travel hacking. Opening and closing credit cards to amass air miles, hotel points, or cash. For accommodations, consider couch surfing, apartment or room rentals, and hostels, all of which can add a more personal connection with locals or fellow travelers versus a hotel. You could also try woofing, worldwide opportunities on organic farms, in which you volunteer your time working on an organic or sustainable farm in exchange for lodging and food. Wherever you go, avoid the tourist traps, eat where the locals do, and walk or use public transportation whenever possible. You'll get a more authentic experience of the place you visit and spend less. If you want to travel somewhere exotic, there just might be someone there who considers your hometown exotic as well. Home exchange sites broker housing swaps, so you could trade Provence, France for Providence, Rhode Island. Also consider volunteer vacations with scientific research groups or service groups. Better to live in a village and help build a school or find a cure for a disease than to whiz through on a shopping excursion, taking pictures, buying artifacts, and leaving the people in the dust. You can house sit, and there are matchmaking sites for that. Some clever FIers actually live in low-budget countries for part of the year to refill low coffers without having to go back to a job. Major costs, such as housing, transportation, and food, are all considerably cheaper, plus you get the joy of traveling rolled right into daily life. Protecting what you own. As you practice the steps in this audiobook, you will invariably become a much more conscious consumer. While this skill will serve you well in all aspects of your purchasing life, it's particularly important when it comes to buying insurance. Before you spend any money in this category, be sure you understand what you are buying. For example, does the current Blue Book value or condition of your car warrant the comprehensive and collision insurance you're carrying? Are you insuring heirlooms that you would never replace if they were stolen? If you have no dependents to support, do you really need life insurance? Review each of your insurance policies carefully to ensure that you are getting maximum value. If you don't understand your policy fully, a reputable insurance agent should be more than willing to explain it. Kathy and Langdon L. paused in doing their monthly tabulations and evaluations when they got to homeowners insurance. They were paying $6 a month to insure some heirloom jewelry from Kathy's grandmother. Applying FI thinking, they realized that they would never be able to replace these priceless treasures. They wouldn't even want to. What made them special was the connection with the past. So what was the $6 a month for? Consolation money? Langdon, with his penchant for figuring things out, calculated how much principal would be required to yield $6 a month in interest by the time they planned to be financially independent. The figure, $1,000, was so convincing that they dropped the insurance. Speaking of dropping insurance, Irene and Quentin did it before paying a penny. They looked at the cost of long-term care insurance to manage the uncertainty of outliving their money, but the expense had them think again. Instead, they chose to self-insure and reduce their risk by aging in place. That is, staying home and staying healthy and connected and active in mind and body. Not having children, they chose to live in a large, multi-generational co-housing community in a place that would work even if they ended up in wheelchairs. Michael Phillips and Catherine Campbell's book, Simple Living Investments for Old Age, dispels the myth of aging as a decline into decrepitude and suggests four strategies for living well while living long. The first is to be active in pursuit of health. Don't just be a pill-popping, insurance-dependent senior. The second is to cultivate new friends, especially younger ones, and to participate in community, both of which remind you daily that you are alive and valued. The third is simplifying possessions while regarding inevitable changes within and around you as the next great adventure rather than the last straw. Finally, attend to traditional investments like owning a house and having enough, but not more than enough, income. Their advice reminds us that protecting what you own, be it a car, house, or body, isn't a more is better matter. Some things take too much time, worry, and money to merit protecting. Choose well what you must protect and how to protect it. It's never too late to think about aging gracefully and frugally, or too early. Raising children. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that it will cost an average American family over $230,000 to raise a child to the age of 18, not including any college expense. Although the numbers are staggering, there are still plenty of FIers who are successfully reducing those costs. In general, it's important for parents to model frugal living. If you curb your own spending, your children will almost always follow suit. If your child is resistant, you might want to give that child a larger-than-normal allowance, but explain that this fund will now have to pay for clothing and other essentials. Many FIers have reported that when their children realized they would have to spend their own money for the stuff they wanted, they became frugal and entrepreneurial quite quickly. Assuming the great outdoors is dangerous or wet, parents too often let children turn on TV and computers for fun. Connecting children with nature gives endless hours of fascination and is largely free. Cultivating a love for the outdoors is a lifelong gift and one that fewer and fewer of us are instilling in our children. Another tip is to substitute creativity for money in as many aspects of your life with children as you can, including planning birthday parties, homemade cakes, and old-fashioned games like potato sack races and water balloon tosses are charming and inexpensive. And Halloween celebrations with handcrafted costumes that are fun to make and much more memorable. If you have tried all forms of creativity and your child still wants something you don't really want to buy, then suggest that you talk about it again in a few days. Most passing fancies are just that. They pass. But if your child keeps asking for a particular item, then you know it's likely a legitimate desire. You can then determine together if and how your child might eventually pay for it. Clothing swaps and giveaways can whittle the cost of kids' clothes down to a pittance. Hand-me-downs now transcend the boundaries of families. Online sharing networks and mom groups facilitate moving clothes around as kids outgrow them. This goes for the full kit of baby needs. Cribs, toys, baby bathtubs, and more. These days, a babysitter for a date night, even a sitter who's barely older than the child he or she is taking care of, can easily cost more than the dinner out. Find another couple with similar-aged children and try doing a weekly date night swap. One night a week, you watch their kids, and the next week, they watch yours. You get a date every other week, pay nothing for babysitting, and the kids will likely love playing with their friends every week. Another option is to join a babysitting co-op. Then there's the biggest child-rearing expense, college. The book, Frugal Living for Dummies, has a solid section on how to reduce college costs. Among the recommendations, have your child take advanced placement or CLEP tests to get early college credits and thereby get through college quicker. The tests cost less than $100 and can save thousands of dollars per credit earned. With enough credits, your child could even enter college as a sophomore. He or she could also attend community college for 2 years, taking advantage of the cheaper tuition, before transferring and graduating from a 4-year school. The Running Start program lets motivated high schoolers complete up to 2 years of college before they graduate, entering college at a junior level. Kathy and Langdon L., economized on college for their 2 children. Is it reasonable, they wondered, for us to work another decade to put them through whatever school they want? In the end, they decided to offer the children tuition for a 4-year in-state college. If they wanted to go out of state or Ivy League, their children would earn the difference either by working or through scholarships. Years ahead of time, tell your children that affordability will be a key factor in choosing which colleges they apply to and which ones they can choose to attend. One of the hidden benefits of living a frugal lifestyle is that being content with less income and fewer assets qualifies you for more college financial aid. Many FIers find that the better endowed private colleges will offer enough need-based aid to make the cost similar to that of a public university, and sometimes even less. Knowing this, use colleges' net price calculators to get a sense for how much need-based aid each school might offer you, and how much of that will be in the form of grants and work-study versus loans. It may turn out that an Ivy League college provides the cheapest education you can get if your child has the grades to get accepted. Throwing stuff away. Of course, if you're doing the steps of this program, very little of what you bring to your house goes out again as trash. Many people at the beginning of transforming their relationship with money have lucrative yard sales to weed out the unwanted items unearthed in their step one inventory. Or they list them on online auction sites or donate them, getting a tax deduction in the process. Kitchen waste can be dug into your garden, put into a compost bin, or fed to worms that will return it to you as rich soil. In wealthier countries, tires as well as paper, aluminum, steel, glass, and cardboard waste can be recycled. Some cities, like New York City, have even instituted composting programs for food waste. Sharing works here as well. Instead of paying for garbage pickup, one apartment renter pays for 1 month of her neighbor's annual trash bill. She brings her little sack of garbage over for weekly pickup and often puts the garbage can out and brings it in as well. While the cost savings on your garbage bill might be minimal, keep looking for ways to turn your trash into treasures. Who knows? Among the possessions gathering dust in your basement, there may be something worth a lot of money. If you suspect that, get it appraised. Gifting and celebrating. For many people, giving presents is an important way to express love. However, you can cut back on the cost of gifts without cutting back on the affection behind them. This is where question 3 from step 4 helps to reveal hidden options. If you didn't have to work for a living, would you give different and less expensive gifts? One of the biggest gift-giving occasions in our culture is Christmas. If holiday celebrations feel excessive, begin to set limits to what feels right to you and your family. Bill McKibben's book, $100 Holiday, may be helpful. Some FIers promise their children one or at most 3 toys at Christmas and let them select the ones they want. This has been Amy and Jim D's strategy once they observe the fulfillment curve at work on Christmas Day. The first 1 or 2 or 3 presents were greeted with squeals of ecstasy, but from then on it was all downhill. Instead of being able to play with what they had, the kids felt compelled to keep opening all their gifts. By the end, they were tired and cranky and nothing suited them. Other gift-giving ideas, useful all year round, include giving services like massages, babysitting, or a home-cooked meal, instead of material objects. You can also buy gifts at garage sales and save them for the right occasion. Regifting, either of gifts you received and couldn't use or new items you bought at a garage sale, is more socially acceptable now than ever. Be sure you don't regift a present to the same person who gave it to you, though, as one very chagrined friend did recently. Finally, a great way to recycle both new and used gifts during the holidays is to organize a Secret Santa party where each attendee brings a wrapped gift and swaps it for another. Ursula K.'s spirits sank as the season for Goodwill to All, i.e. Christmas, approached. With parents, siblings, in-laws, nieces, and nephews, she needed to buy over 20 gifts. After much soul-searching, she saw she had a choice. Her solvency and sanity, or sticking with the way it's always been done. She took a deep breath and wrote a letter to each family member expressing her love for them and her desire to neither give nor receive Christmas presents. She steeled herself for resistance, but what she got back was respect. By the way, Ursula also hosted her own wedding, organizing her large network of friends to cater, entertain, and even perform the ceremony. There you have some hints and tips, the biggest one of which is what Ursula did. Observe reality, tell yourself the truth about what you really want and need, and have the courage to buck convention with integrity and respect. This isn't scrimping and saving. It's being wise and savvy. The desire to do whatever you want whenever you want and damn the consequences seems to be an underlying current in the free world. But as we've seen, such freedom is often quite costly, whereas consciousness often saves you far more money and thus liberates far more time. Partnering. Those who practice these frugality strategies know that life gets more interesting and delightful as you discover new ways to economize. At very least, you get great bragging rights if you are lucky enough to find others who share your values and admire your clever tactics. Such companions can boost both your spirits and your skills, while going it alone can leave you feeling like an odd duck in a society that encourages wasteful spending. If you want to change but your partner doesn't yet, you might seek out like-minded people or groups to support and inspire you. Luckily, with the global FIRE, Financial Independence Retire Early, community of bloggers and practitioners, together with a myriad of online and face-to-face ways to connect, it's far easier to find like-minded friends and lovers. Anne Habig and Fred X met on an online simple living discussion board. Their frugal values, as well as their desires for their lives, matched. But that wasn't always the case. When he was younger, Fred, with his master's in computer science, had a garage full of toys and mounting debt, and he was tired of being tired all the time. That's when he read an article that mentioned Your Money or Your Life, bought the book, and after holing up for a weekend devouring it, dedicated himself to saying goodbye to paid work forever. He was 27 at the time, and by 35, he was retired, and living cheap with style. On the way, he sold his house, left his marriage, started to shop in thrift stores, lived in rented rooms, cooked for himself, and began enjoying himself more, traveling, sailing, and even taking a job with an environmental organization in Europe at a third the pay, but twice the fun. Anne had tried for years to live her environmental values, but ended up, again and again, being another bored dot-commer for the money. Your Money or Your Life, and later Fred, confirmed her sense that life could be different and showed her the way to make it happen. She kept whittling down her expenses while saving and saving some more, and now she works very part-time. She and Fred live in a houseboat in San Francisco, travel together, and volunteer helping others think through their own money lives. She reports, "Much of what I do now, I do for free. I have time for triathlon training, bicycle advocacy work, and practicing guitar. We were car-free for 5 years here, but now have a car so we can get to further-flung trails. Fred also works very occasionally for races for pay. He doesn't do this out of financial necessity. Fred and I have a strong relationship based on shared values, and we have time for each other. Life is good." Fred and Anne are acutely aware that our consumption impacts the earth, and they make their spending choices with this in mind. It feeds their consciences while pulling their expense line down. Save money, save the planet? It isn't just an odd coincidence that saving money and saving the planet are connected. In fact, in some sense, your money is the planet. Here's how. Money is a lien on the Earth's resources. Every time we spend money on anything, we are consuming not only the metal, plastic, wood, and other materials in the item itself, but also all the resources it took to extract these from the Earth, transport them to the manufacturer, process them, assemble the product, ship it to the retailer, and bring it from the store to your home. All of that activity and cost is somehow included in the price of, say, a new computer. Then there are the environmental costs that aren't included in the price, what economists call externalities. The pollution and waste we pay for in other ways. The lung disease, cancer, respiratory problems, desertification, flooding, and so on. What it boils down to is that every time we spend money, we are voting for the kind of planet we want to leave to future generations. Money is a lien on the life energy of the planet. We call this the Pogonomics principle, economics from a cartoon character Pogo's point of view. Pogo's contribution to Earth Day 1970 was the observation that we have met the enemy and he is us. It's no mystery why the planet is polluted. We did it through our demand for more, better, and different stuff. And that is something we can do something about and benefit ourselves in the process. Creative frugality is a double win for our wallets and the world. The point of all this is not to send you off into the desert to eat berries and wear fig leaves. It is especially important to remember the mantra, no shame, no blame. We were all born into a world where consuming is part of life, and consuming our way to happiness seemed both natural and benign. The kinds of changes we may all need to make to keep the environment viable will require some deliberate and courageous modifications of our current habits. But why wait? Start to live with these questions now. You will see so many places where you can choose a non-polluting pleasure and have twice the fulfillment. Once for you and once for the planet. Indeed, enjoying nature and feeling your vital connection to the Earth, the source of all life, is one of the greatest pleasures there is. If you want to find how to save money while saving the Earth, many fine books, blogs, and websites are available that can help you to reevaluate your personal lifestyle choices in light of our current understanding about the human impact on the ecosystem. Get the books from the library. It's a great way to save a tree. The key is remembering that anything you buy and don't use, anything you throw away, anything you consume and don't enjoy is money down the drain, wasting your life energy, and wasting the finite resources of the planet. Any waste of your life energy means more hours lost to the rat race and making a dying. Frugality is the user-friendly and earth-friendly lifestyle. The Dalai Lama says, when we talk about preservation of the planet, it is related to many other things. Ultimately, the decision must come from the human heart. So I think the key point is to have a genuine sense of universal responsibility. 1001 sure ways to save money. After a year of keeping your monthly tabulations, you will have approximately 1001 single entries under your 15 to 30 spending categories. Chances are very good that you could be spending less on every purchase from apples to zinnias with no reduction in the quality of the product or the quality of your life. It's the attitude of honoring your life energy that will show you the way, not following somebody else's recipe for a frugal life. You will be as excited about the savings you discover as we have been about furnishing our home from garage sales and giveaways. The empowerment comes from your cleverness and your creativity in finding your strategies for frugality. That's why we call it creative frugality. So here's a blank slate. Write your own 1001 tips for living on less and loving it. A million and one sure ways to save money. Watch your thoughts. Anyone who practices meditation knows that the gray matter between our ears, like a frenetic monkey, churns out a steady stream of unrelated thoughts at the rate of at least one a second. In just 11.6 days, you'll have a million and one thoughts, and most of them will have something to do with desires. I want this. I don't want that. I like this. I don't like that. The Buddha said that desire is the source of all suffering. It is also the source of all shopping. By being conscious of your next million and one desires, you will have a million and one opportunities to not spend money on something that won't bring you fulfillment. Advertising doesn't make you buy stuff. Other people's expectations don't make you buy stuff. Television doesn't make you buy stuff. Your thoughts make you buy stuff. Watch those suckers. They're dangerous to your pocketbook and a whole lot more. Checklist. Think before you spend. 1. Don't go shopping. 2. Live within your means. 3. Take care of what you have. 4. Wear it out. 5. Do it yourself. 6. Anticipate your needs. 7. Research value, quality, durability, multiple use, and price. 8. Buy it for less. 9. Meet your needs differently. 10. Follow the 9 steps of this program. Summary of Step 6. Lower your total monthly expenses by valuing your life energy and increasing your consciousness in spending. Learn to choose quality of life over standard of living. Money Talk Questions. Rugged individualism is a losing strategy for figuring out ways to lower your expenses while increasing your fulfillment. Harvest attitudes and practical tips from these conversations while appreciating how consumerism makes us crazy. Using the suggestions in the epilogue for how to have a money talk, raise these questions in your daily reflections with your partners or in social groups. Remember, adding why to the end of any question will take it deeper. Adding how has society shaped my answer to any question will take it wider. There are no right answers. Whom are you trying to impress or please through what you have or how you spend? How do you economize? On what? How do you feel about it? Talk about one thing you own that you love. What do you love about it? Take us shopping with you, describing where you are, how you feel, and what you buy. What's your gazingus pin? You gotta have it purchase. What's the last item you actually wore out? Chapter 7. For Love or Money. Valuing Your Life Energy, Work, and Income. In Chapter 6, we talked about valuing your life energy by spending your money more consciously. In this chapter, we will talk about valuing your life energy by looking at how well you spend your time. Are you getting full value for selling that most precious commodity, your life? Does work work for you? Sometimes you have to question the obvious in order to get at the truth. The question we will be exploring in this chapter is, what is work? Common wisdom says that work is what we do to make a living. But that definition robs us of our life. Some of us honor our jobs and neglect the rest of our lives. Some of us endure our jobs and make up for it on the evenings and weekends. Some of us work from home and never get downtime. Some piece together several jobs in the gig economy, but BYOB, be your own boss, consumes every waking hour. Some of us love our work, or did once and hope to again, but find our personal vision constrained by boards, supervisors, funders, or investors. When work equals what you do for money, It means the work of our free time is of lesser value. We fail to value our life energy and often feel helpless about making changes. What we will be exploring now is whether our definition of work itself is part of the problem. How well are you using your life energy, both on and off the job? Is your job consuming, as in using up, destroying, and wasting your life? Do you love your life, using each hour on and off the job with care? As we said in Chapter 2, our life energy is precious because it is limited and irretrievable, and because our choices about how we use it express the meaning and purpose of our time here on Earth. So far, you have learned to value your life energy by aligning your spending with your fulfillment and your values. Now it's time to learn about valuing your life energy by maximizing your compensation, in love or money, for the hours you invest in your work. What is work? Just as with money, our concept of work consists of a patchwork of contradictory beliefs, thoughts, and feelings, notions we've absorbed from our parents, our culture, the media, and our life experience. The following quotations highlight the incongruity of our different definitions of work. E.F. Schumacher, an influential 20th century economist, says, "The three purposes of human work are as follows. First, to provide necessary and useful goods and services. Second, to enable every one of us to use and thereby perfect our gifts like good stewards. Third, to do so in service to and in cooperation with others, so as to liberate ourselves from our inborn egocentricity." The late economist Robert Theobald tells us, "Work is defined as something that people do not want to do, and money is the reward that compensates for the unpleasantness of the work." Studs Terkel begins his book Working this way. "This book, being about work, is by its very nature about violence, to the spirit as well as to the body. It's about ulcers as well as accidents, about shouting matches as well as fistfights, about nervous breakdowns as well as kicking the dog around. It is above all, or beneath all, about daily humiliations. To survive the day is triumph enough for the walking wounded among the great many of us. It is about a search, too, for daily meaning as well as daily bread, for recognition as well as cash, for astonishment rather than torpor. In short, for a sort of life rather than a Monday through Friday sort of dying." 20th century poet Khalil Gibran, on the other hand, tells us, "Work is love made visible." What is work? Is it a blessing or a curse? A trial or a triumph? Our task will be to redefine work the same way we redefined money, by looking at what we can say about work that is consistently true. Work through the ages. Let's begin by taking a brief look at the history of work, for it is through looking at history that we find new opportunities to shape our own personal stories. Where do our concepts about work come from? Why do we work? And what is the place of work in our lives? Minimum daily requirement of work. As human beings, we all must do some work for basic survival. But how much? Is there a minimum daily requirement of work? A number of diverse sources, studies ranging from hunter-gatherer cultures to modern history, would place this figure at about 3 hours a day during an adult lifetime. Marshall Salins, author of Stone Age Economics, discovered that before Western influence changed daily life, Kung men who lived in the Kalahari hunted from 2 to 2.5 days a week, with an average work week of 15 hours. Women gathered for about the same period of time each week. In fact, one day's work supplied a woman's family with vegetables for the next 3 days. Throughout the year, both men and women worked for a couple days, then took a couple days off to rest and play games, gossip, plan rituals, and visit. It would appear that the work week in the old days beats today's banker's hours by quite a bit. This suggests that 3 hours a day is all that we must spend working for survival. One can imagine that in pre-industrial times, this pattern would make sense. Life was more whole back then, when work blended with family time and religious celebrations and play. Then came the quote-unquote labor-saving industrial revolution and the compartmentalization of life into work and non-work, with work taking an ever bigger bite out of the average person's day. In the 19th century, the common man, with justified aversion to long hours on the job, began to fight for shorter work weeks. Champions for the workers claimed that fewer hours on the job would decrease fatigue and increase productivity. Indeed, they said, fewer hours was the natural expression of the maturing industrial revolution. People would pursue learning, and educated and engaged citizenry would support our democracy. But all that came to a halt during the Depression. The work week, having fallen dramatically from 60 hours at the turn of the century to 35 hours during the Depression, became locked in at 40 hours for many and has crept up to 50 or even 60 hours a week in recent years. Why? The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of a paycheck. During the Depression, free time became equated with unemployment. In an effort to boost the economy and reduce unemployment, the New Deal established the 40-hour work week, and the government as the employer of last resort. Workers were educated to consider employment, not free time, to be their right as citizens. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of a paycheck? Benjamin Klein Hunnicutt, in Work Without End, illuminates the doctrine of full employment. Since the Depression, few Americans have thought of work reduction as a natural, continuous, and positive result of economic growth and increased productivity. Instead, additional leisure has been seen as a drain on the economy, a liability on wages, and an abandonment of economic progress. The myths of growth is good and full employment establish themselves as key values. These dovetailed nicely with the gospel of full consumption, which preached that leisure is a commodity to be consumed rather than free time to be enjoyed. For the past half century, full employment has meant more consumers with more, quote-unquote, disposable income. This means increased profits, which means business expansion, which means more jobs, which means more consumers with more disposable income. Consumption keeps the wheels of progress moving, as we saw in Chapter 1. So we see that our concept, as a society, of leisure has changed radically. From being considered a desirable and civilizing component of day-to-day life, it has become something to be feared, a reminder of unemployment during the years of depression. As the value of leisure has dropped, the value of work has risen. The push for full employment, along with the growth of advertising, has created a populace increasingly oriented toward work and toward earning more money in order to consume more resources. To counter all this, a free time movement has sprung up in the early 21st century, a campaign called Take Back Your Time, initiated by filmmaker John DeGraff, advocates for shorter work hours and longer vacations for overworked Americans. Even with all the studies saying that the reduced work hours and sufficient leisure actually increase worker productivity, time advocates are swimming upstream against a cultural assumption that the 8-hour workday is next to godliness. The emerging slow food movement also challenges our workaholic lifestyle. This movement suggests that eating is far more than wolfing down fast food alone at your computer, fueling the body for the next big leg of the rat race. Rather, it is a time of conviviality, pleasure, and conversation. In short, it's civilizing. Work takes on new meaning. In addition, according to Hunnicutt, during the last half century, we've begun to lose the fabric of family, culture, and community that gives meaning to life outside the workplace. The traditional rituals, the socializing, and the simple pleasure of one another's company all provided structure for non-work time, affording people a sense of purpose and belonging. Without this experience of being part of a people in a place, leisure leads more often to loneliness and boredom. Because life outside the workplace has lost vitality and meaning, work has ceased being a means to an end and become an end in itself. Honeycutt notes, meaning, justification, purpose, and even salvation were now sought in work, without a necessary reference to any traditional philosophic or theological structure. Men and women were answering the old religious questions in new ways, and the answers were more and more in terms of work, career, occupation, and professions. Arlie Hochschild, in her 2001 book, The Time Bind, says that families now have three jobs, work, home, and repair of relationships damaged by ever more time at the office. Even corporations with quote-unquote family-friendly policies subtly reward people who spend more time at work, whether they are more productive or not. Some are more hectic, inducing a guilty desire to spend more time working because it's more restful. The final piece of the puzzle snaps into place when we look at the shift in the religious attitude toward work that came with the rise of the Protestant ethic. Before that time, work was profane and religion was sacred. Afterwards, work was seen as the arena where you worked out your salvation, and the evidence of a successful religious life was a successful financial life. So here we are in the 21st century. Our paid employment has taken on a myriad of roles. Our jobs now serve the function that traditionally belonged to religion. They are the place where we seek answers to the perennial questions of who am I, why am I here, and what's it all for? They also serve the function of families, giving answers to the questions, who are my people? Where do I belong? Our jobs are called upon to provide the exhilaration of romance and the depth of love. It's as though we believe there is a job charming out there, like Prince Charming in the fairy tales, that will fill our needs and inspire us to greatness. We've come to believe that through this job, we would somehow have it all. Status, meaning, adventure, travel, luxury, respect, power, tough challenges, and fantastic rewards. All we need to do is find Mr. or Ms. Right. Mr. or Ms. Right job, that is. Indeed, in terms of sheer hours, we may be more wedded to our jobs than to our partners. The vows for better or worse, richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, and off until death do us part, may be better applied to our jobs than to our wives or husbands. Perhaps what keeps some of us stuck in the home freeway office loop is this very job-charming illusion. We're like the princess who keeps kissing toads, hoping one day to find herself hugging a handsome prince. Our jobs are our toads. Young people today are swimming against an even stronger current. Our phones and laptops keep us on call to our employers and side hustles, the second and third jobs that fit into the cracks of the main one, 24/7. When your primary job isn't enough, it's hard to patch together enough hustles to pay off student loans and graduate from living in your parents' basement. The fact that they've dubbed their multiple jobs as hustles indicates how much energy it takes to fledge and flourish. They know full well they are in a brave new world of endless hustle, brave as in it takes courage to move against that undertow. The old conveyor belt of job as identity, as career, as security, as pension is now utterly shredded. Does this liberate young people from the job's charming syndrome? No. If they are always hustling, they are always on the job. Even dating can become networking for the next job opportunity. Did we win the Industrial Revolution? We've come a long way since the time when our ancestors worked 3 hours a day and enjoyed the pleasures of socializing, rituals, celebrations, and games the rest of the time. Has it been worth it? We certainly gained a tremendous amount by focusing our creativity and ingenuity on mastering the physical world. Science, technology, culture, art, language, and music have all evolved and brought us countless blessings. Few of us would want to turn back the clock entirely, forsaking Bach or penicillin. We do need to stop the clock, however, and evaluate our direction. Are we still on course? Let's look briefly at the modern workplace and job market. Where are we? And is it where we want to be? Some workers feel underemployed. Their day is filled with repetitive, menial, or unchallenging tasks that call forth very little of their creativity or intelligence. Others feel overworked, especially now with corporate downsizing shifting more and more responsibilities.